The Will to Survive, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. In a speech in Poland, Donald Trump lays out a vision of a Western civilization under threat.
The fundamental question of our time is whether the West has the will to survive. Do we have the confidence in our values to defend them at any cost?
Polls in the audience seem to appreciate the message.
Imagine the people in Poland wearing red caps from Donald Trump campaign with the sign Make America Great Again.
Plus, some advice if you're looking to buy Iraqi antiquities for your Bible museum.
If you've got 3,000 undocumented new Iraqi tablets sitting in front of you, there's only one place it came from, which is from looting.
It's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and it's The World. Talk about a contrast. When President Trump arrived in Hamburg, Germany today ahead of the G20 meeting, there were already protests in the streets. Police there using water cannon and pepper spray to clear demonstrators. Just hours earlier in Poland, the vibe was friendlier. That's people in Warsaw cheering for Donald Trump today. The president was giving a speech in Krasinski Square near the site of the 1944 Warsaw Uprising against the Nazis. Trump compared what Poles faced in World War II to the challenges he says the West faces today.
The fundamental question of our time is whether the West has the will to survive. Do we have the confidence in our values to defend them at any cost? Do we have enough respect for our citizens to protect our borders?
It's not surprising that Trump got a warm welcome in Poland. He enjoys a political kinship with the ruling right-wing party there. Bartosz Wieliński was among the crowd listening to President Trump's address. He's the foreign editor of Gazeta Wyborcza. It's a Polish daily started by the Democratic opposition in 1989. He says the audience today looked a little like a Trump campaign rally.
Imagine the people in Poland wearing red caps from Donald Trump campaign with the sign Make America Great Again. I've seen dozens of people wearing such hats. There are people brought from small towns and rural areas, and they were just carrying a lot of U.S. flags and Polish flags also. When the politicians of the government were entering Krasinski Square, they were simply applauding them. When the members of opposition were there, they were, well, shouting at them. Very wild behavior. I was deeply ashamed at this verbal abuse against the Polish opposition. We are still a democratic country where the opposition has its rights. And imagine Donald Tusk is the president of European Council. He's the former prime minister of Poland. They started suddenly to shout, Donald Tusk is a liar. Donald Tusk is a thief. We don't want Tusk, we want Trump. So there was such kind of, you know, vile emotions which were present. And as I said, I was astonished and deeply ashamed that journalists from other countries had to see that.
What did you want to hear from Trump's speech?
I was expecting a global vision. He's a new president. It was announced as his first major speech in Europe and abroad. And I was expecting that the global leader, leader of the free world, would propose his vision to solve global issues. I find the speech of Donald Trump unfortunately dull. There was nothing serious inside. There was, well, no serious content. I was expecting to hear a world leader with his agenda, with his vision, how to tackle terrorism, global warming, well, injustice. And Donald Trump didn't say anything of that.
I know President Trump told the Polish people today that he takes NATO and the defense of Eastern Europe seriously. Was that important for Poles to hear?
Yeah, that was extremely important because we need NATO, we need United States, and we need soldiers on the ground to protect us from any possible hostile action from our big neighbor, I mean Russia.
Are Poles worried about greater collaboration between Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin?
Of course, the United States and Russia must collaborate, solving global issues. And, of course, Poland must also collaborate with Russia. But, of course, we are afraid that Trump and Putin would decide which part of the world would be free and which one would be under Russian supervision. That's the way of thinking we are afraid of. And we don't know. Donald Trump is unpredictable and anything could happen. But what is interesting, United States remains one of the most beloved countries in Poland. There is no other capital in the world, probably, than Warsaw, when a crowd would shout his name with such great emotion as was done in Warsaw today. So now he has a proof that not all Europeans despise of him, that he is loved in Poland. And that was the idea of this trip.
Bartosz Wieliński was among the crowd listening to President Trump's address. He's the foreign editor of Gazeta Wyborcza. It's a Polish daily that supports the Democratic opposition. Thanks so much, Bartosz.
It was a pleasure.
Trump may have felt embraced in Poland, but his policies and rhetoric have created a rift between the U.S. and some of its traditional European allies. And some analysts say China has been looking to fill that void.
The rhetoric certainly leaves the road open for China. The question is China really able to take it?
That's François Godemont. He directs the Asia and China program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He says China has been trying to position itself as a defender of multilateralism and free trade.
But it's not really filling the gaps, filling the holes. Let's look at the example of trade. Obviously, with protectionist threats from the U.S., China would look very good if it was making concessions at the same time on trading agreements. That's what Europe has been asking for years. But the fact is that, contrary to expectations, it hasn't done so.
Now, Germany is embracing China as a key partner on issues like climate change. Does that fit with China's own ambitions?
Everybody is sort of leaning on China to keep the Paris climate deal open. And that's because, of course, Donald Trump has distanced himself from it. Does it really mean that China is going any further? I don't think so. And we have the remarkable example before the G20 of China in advance saying that it doesn't want any country singled out and isolated within the G20. In the past, that could have been China, but today it is America. So we have the extraordinary fact that because China still needs to deal with Donald Trump, it doesn't want to win an easy soft power victory, an easy public diplomacy victory, and then pay the price with the U.S. So I think, except at the level of declarations of intentions, partners will be disappointed.
Disappointed in what?
Disappointed by the fact that behind the good words, China doesn't really change its stance on many issues, like trade, like respect for international law. And even on climate so far, what China is just saying that it's keeping to what it signed for the Paris Agreement, but that doesn't have many legal requirements. That's a long-term goal, and so it's not really very demanding of China.
So as the G20 prepare to meet, what are you looking for the most in this meeting?
I'm looking above all for something that would concern international trade. And I'm looking for concessions by China that would indeed make it possible to tell Donald Trump to stop his antics about protectionism generally. Europeans have already got a fairly good preparation for that by signing a free trade agreement with Japan, which is, of course, also present at G20. Europe and Japan together are the biggest trading bloc in the world. So a free trade agreement that has been signed after much difficulty, I might add, is significant. I think it is there that the G20 can be very useful. Of course, it can act as a reminder on climate issues. It can act as a reminder on international law, which would rather be addressed to China. But we know the practical usefulness is still very limited.
François Godemont directs the Asia and China program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks to you.
Remember Hobby Lobby? That's the arts and crafts chain that won a Supreme Court decision saying it didn't have to provide contraceptive coverage for its employees. Hobby Lobby is owned by the Green family, who are evangelical Christians, and they're opening a Bible museum in Washington, D.C. But that's gotten them into some trouble. Federal authorities say Hobby Lobby purchased thousands of ancient cuneiform tablets looted from Iraq and ignored red flags that the objects were stolen. Hobby Lobby has agreed to pay a fine of $3 million and return the artifacts. In a statement, the company said they didn't appreciate the complexities of the acquisition process. Donnie Yates specializes in antiquities. On your website today, you wrote that you can't collect antiquities on a massive scale like the Greens do without buying looted objects, and that everybody knows this. Is this just kind of something that's commonly known?
It is. One of my colleagues, Simon McKenzie, who is at the University of Glasgow and the University of Victoria at Wellington, has done a lot of research interviewing people who work in the antiquities trade. And a lot of the market runs on basically just not asking certain questions, of creating plausible deniability, of implying things but leaving things unsaid. And a lot of this shields some of the more dubious activity within the market. And when we think about this scale, this mass scale, again, we're talking in this case of over 3,000 antiquities. There's no place for it to come from in a legal way. There's no hidden source of 3,000 Iraqi tablets that is not in a museum or not already in a known collection, but has been out of Iraq for the past 100 years. It just doesn't exist. So in a sense, if you've got 3,000 undocumented new Iraqi tablets sitting in front of you, there's only one place it came from, which is from looting.
Donna, you know a lot about cases like this, and there's aspects of this case that I'm certain you're familiar with. And one of them is the fact that the Greens consulted experts, and those experts warned them that these antiquities were probably looted, but the Greens go ahead and purchase them anyway. What does the research say about why a person will go ahead and buy art, even if it's been stolen?
Well, in a sense, this is classic white-collar crime behavior. This is a feeling that you are outside of the law, or just the law doesn't quite apply to you. In a lot of research that my colleagues and I have done on the motivations of collectors, and collectors who specifically end up engaging with the illicit market, is that they see themselves as saving the antiquities. So they create this internal story where the antiquity would have been destroyed if I didn't collect it, or whoever has it, the Iraqis can't protect it. I can. I have that ability. It's a total construction around justifying what is absolutely a crime. So I can only speculate in this case, but of course, in this case, you have a situation where the Greens might be thinking, well, I'm going to present it in a museum, so that's a good thing, even if there's a dodgy side to it. My motivations are good, so that excuses the bad behavior.
And I should say, we did reach out to Hobby Lobby and ask them why they ignored the red flags around these antiquities. The company hasn't yet responded to that question.
I would love to hear their response.
Donna, this is yet another case of stolen antiquities. This particular sale was intercepted. These objects will be returned to Iraq. But is there any kind of lasting harm?
Absolutely. And I think that that's something that needs to be emphasized in cases like this. We seize these objects, they'll probably be returned, but what we can never gain back is the information that we would have gathered if they were archaeologically excavated, the context, the information about history that they once contained. We may be able to read the tablets, but we'll never know if they were together in a library, if they were with other artifacts. All of this really exciting, important information about the past, that's destroyed at the point of looting, and we just can never get that back. We've all been robbed of something in this case.
Donna Yates specializes in antiquities theft. She's at the University of Glasgow. Thanks, Donna.
Thank you.
Coming up, cartooning the life of a North Korean defector. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. From everything we know about North Korea, it seems like a place you'd want to escape. And more North Koreans are doing that. They usually make their way to South Korea. Same language, same culture. But it's not an easy transition. A North Korean refugee named Choi Sung-gok has created a comic strip that shows what defectors go through when they escape and try to make a new life in the South. It might not seem like a storyline with a lot of laughs, but Choi finds humor in his own experiences. Jason Strother tells his story from Seoul.
There's a rumor that parts of The Lion King were animated in an unlikely place, North Korea.
Ah,
Choi Song-gok doesn't believe this rumor, and he might know better than anyone else. He used to work as an animator at a studio in Pyongyang. The 37-year-old tells me about his old job over iced coffees at a cafe in Seoul, where he lives now.
Lion King, Pocahontas, Titanic animation.
We made our own versions of The Lion King, Pocahontas, and an animated Titanic movie. I guess this rumor about the studio working for Disney began because of these movies.
Choi says he's had a knack for drawing ever since he was a kid. In a country like North Korea, where all art serves a political agenda, he won praise from teachers for sketching pictures of evil American soldiers, like the one he shows me on his smartphone. He says the trick was to make them look as ugly and violent as possible. He laughs now about how brainwashed he says he was back then. Choi says he had a good life in Pyongyang, and working as an animator for the government was kind of a dream job. Employees received sacks of sugar, beef, and refrigerators as gifts. But his fortunes later changed. To make a long and harrowing story short, Choi got into trouble with the authorities for possessing banned foreign DVDs. He tried escaping to China, but got caught and wound up in a labor camp. Finally, in 2010, he made it to South Korea. North Korean refugees, there are some 30,000 in the South, face many cultural and even linguistic differences that make resettlement difficult. For Choi, one of the things that stood out to him first was that cartoons here weren't anything like the ones back in the North.
When I first saw South Korean cartoons, I just didn't get them. There were no stories about patriotism or catching spies or war. They just seemed useless to me.
But in 2016, Choi got back into drawing and started a cartoon of his own online. Like many North Korean defectors, he was eager to tell his story. He calls his series the Nodong Shimmun, which means labor interrogation. It's a play on the name of North Korea's Nodong Shinmun, the labor newspaper. It follows a group of newly arrived refugees as they spend their first months in the South at a government-run integration center. Choi pokes fun at their newbiness, like their shock at all the food at a buffet restaurant, or how during a field trip to one of Seoul's tallest buildings, some were afraid to go to the top. He also tells the story of one lovelorn defector that he says is based on his own embarrassing cultural misunderstanding.
One time, I met a South Korean woman who asked for my phone number and said she wanted to become my friend. I somehow misinterpreted that as she wanted to marry me.
In the comic, the woman uses a term of endearment that's casually spoken in South Korea. In a text bubble, Choi explains how that caused mixed signals.
In North Korea, only romantic partners would say that to each other. Amongst friends, we just call each other comrade.
Choi's webtoon receives tens of thousands of views. Some fans leave comments like it's helped them understand the cultural differences between North and South Korea. Others write that they feel more empathetic now toward refugees. Choi's encouraged by those words because, as he says, many South Koreans just don't care about North Korea or its defectors. Even though Choi's comic strip is supposed to be a satire, not everything is funny. There are scenes of people starving in North Korean streets and escapees being shot at by soldiers.
Some defectors say I depict North Korea too negatively, that my cartoons hurt their pride. But 90% say they like it. Some even say if people back in the North see these, they'd understand life in South Korea better.
It's still surprising to me that Choi can find any humor in North Korea. He tells me that he believes his sister died in a prison camp there. I ask him how he does it.
I don't let the bad memories affect me. My humor today comes from my experiences during my childhood. I think a person's sense of humor depends on how happy they were during those years.
Choi adds that even if life is hell, you can still find some humor in it. For The World, Jason Strother, Seoul.
We've got some of Choi's cartoons up at PRI.org. Check out the translations and notes about mixed signals and cultural snafus. Sometimes it's nice to leave our troubled planet behind and think about another world. So how about Mercury? The European Space Agency, along with Japanese scientists, is very interested in the rocky planet. They're putting the finishing touches on a new mission to Mercury. The craft is called Bepi Colombo, and it's going on a long road trip.
It's a journey that's going to take us 7.5 years.
Mark McCorkin is the European Space Agency's senior advisor for science and exploration.
Mercury is incredibly hard to get to. It's actually easier to get to the outer solar system than it is to Mercury. You'd think with the gravity it would be easy to get there, but the real problem is slowing down when we get there.
Then there's this.
It's incredibly hot.
Elizabeth Pearson is an astrophysicist and news editor of the BBC's Sky at Night magazine.
It's the closest planet to the sun. Bepi Colombo is going to have to deal with some pretty extreme conditions. It's in fact so close to the sun that it can't point its solar panels fully at the sun, which means that it actually needs to have bigger solar panels, even though it's going to be the closest mission to the sun, which I think is quite odd. And it's going to have to also be quite radiation hard, is what it's called, which means that it's going to have to deal with all of the radiation that's coming off of the sun without getting its circuits fried.
Despite the challenges, scientists are convinced the trip is worth it. They hope to find out more about Mercury's unique atmosphere and the planet's core.
Its central iron core makes up about 60% of its volume. On Earth, it's more like 15%. So that's a huge difference. And they're trying to work out exactly what it's been stripped away. That's one of the things we're trying to investigate.
At the heart of it all, says Pearson, are the big questions.
Who are we? How did we get here? And I think that's one of those universal questions that links everybody together. And I think it's really important that we learn about those big questions and try and answer them.
Bepi Colombo's just passed some critical pre-launch tests. It looks like all systems go for blastoff in October of 2018. I'm Carol Hills. A woman retraces her Jewish grandmother's escape from Czechoslovakia.
When I started this project in 2009, I wouldn't necessarily have said it was timely.
But that was before Europe's migrant crisis.
And they take me to this house that they said my grandmother stayed in, and what I found was a whole group of unaccompanied refugees.
That's story ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. 3 years ago, the so-called Islamic State announced the beginning of its caliphate, and it made the ancient city of Raqqa its de facto capital in Syria. Today, Raqqa is still partly in ISIS hands, as U.S.-backed coalition forces fight street by street to regain control. It's a place where very few Western journalists have been able to go recently, but my BBC colleague, Gabriel Gatehouse, has just returned from being embedded with anti-ISIS forces.
The way they're fighting really is that they're in very small units, quite lightly armed, quite mobile, maybe 10 or 12 people. They go in, they take a position perhaps in a building near to where IS is holed up, and then they try and hold that position. But IS are also mobile. They're digging tunnels underground. They're coming at them with car bombs, with weaponized drones. So it's a very confusing picture, really, and quite a dangerous fight, because you can be there with them and you think that IS are perhaps a couple of hundred meters up ahead of you, and then suddenly they pop up behind you.
Did that ever happen to you, that IS suddenly pops up when you think they're not around?
Yes, it did. Well, we knew they were around, but we thought they were somewhere else. I mean, we went in with some Kurdish fighters that we'd been spending some time with, and we were very cautious to make sure that we knew where we were going, that they knew where they were going, and that they knew where IS was supposed to be. And they showed us their map on their, they all have these tablets with little yellow dots for all of their forces. And we thought we were going somewhere that there was a position that had been held for 5 days by them, that was kind of well inside territory they controlled. We got to where we were going in our improvised armored truck, and the gunner suddenly started firing out of the top of the vehicle, and we reversed and backed up. I said, what was going on? And they said, well, we just run into some ISIS fighters. We then drove back about 3 or 4 minutes through these narrow streets, and took shelter in a building where another unit of Kurdish fighters were holed up. And they were looking out over the next door building, which was literally a matter of a couple of dozen meters away, where they said another IS unit was in that building, sniping at them, shooting at them. So what you see is this very kind of disparate picture on the ground.
Give us a sense of how big Raqqa is and then how much of it the Islamic State still controls.
Raqqa is a sizable city, and the bit that Islamic State now controls is basically the old walled city, so the sort of medieval part of it, which is obviously a quite dense area of the city, very, very narrow streets again. And this is what it's going to make it so hard for the SDF to take. They are getting support from the Americans, both artillery and airstrikes. We saw that ourselves quite frequently. You'd hear the rumble of a plane overhead and then a deep thud of some kind of bomb being dropped. But what it's going to come down to, a bit like Mosul, is going to be street-to-street fighting. And I think it could take some months still.
And the civilians there are at risk of being killed by IS, but they're also at risk of being killed by the Kurdish-led attacks.
And by the Americans.
And the Americans.
Because they're dropping some very, very serious firepower on them there. And we did hear some alarming figures coming out from the United Nations a few weeks ago talking about what they said were staggering levels of civilian casualties. I spoke to the American general in charge of the overall operation, the coalition against Islamic State, General Stephen Townsend. He said that this was, and I quote him here, the most accurate military campaign ever conducted in the history of the world. He said they were being as careful as they possibly could be. Now, that may well be true, but it is the case that this is a very densely populated area, and when you're dropping big bombs, people are going to die.
Why is Raqqa so important for the Islamic State?
Raqqa is the capital of their caliphate, this caliphate that they declared 3 years ago. So in a sense, when Raqqa falls, symbolically, it is the end of their caliphate. It won't be the end of Islamic State. They will flee out of town. They will go to other towns. Even if they lose all of their cities and territory, it's probably not going to be the end of them full stop, because as we've seen, they're very capable of carrying out attacks far from their bases in Syria, in Europe and elsewhere.
Now, we've been talking about Raqqa today in Syria, and for many days we've been talking about Mosul in Iraq. And these two cities are part of this IS-controlled land that's shrinking, but it still straddles Syria and Iraq. Is it continuing to shrink?
Yes, it is continuing to shrink, and the assault on, Mosul is pretty much done now. The assault on Raqqa is part of that. After Raqqa, I think we'll see them moving down towards Deir ez-Zor, further south and to the east. So their territory is shrinking, but I think that doesn't necessarily mean that their power vanishes.
The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse, he's just back from the front lines of the fight in Raqqa. Thank you.
My pleasure.
A story now about what happens to some of the millions of Syrians who've been forced from their homes. A tiny number of them have made their way to Japan. But the country isn't exactly putting out the welcome mat. Last year, a record number of people applied for refugee status in Japan. 99% of them were rejected. From Tokyo, Abigail Leonard has the story of one of the few Syrians who did get asylum.
Jamal is 25, and he's a student at Meiji University. Today, he's headed to sports rehab for a nagging soccer injury.
It's my dream to be professional, so every day, training, exercising, doing your rehab.
Jamal says his prospects here in Japan are better than in his native Syria, where connections to President Bashar al-Assad matter more than athletic ability.
Because in Syria, everything, even in the national team, most of players, because they know someone in the Assad's place. So it works like this in Syria everywhere.
Jamal asked that we not use his last name to protect families still in Syria. When the anti-government protests started in 2011, Jamal joined in, hoping for modest reforms. But then Assad's government began killing protesters. And in 2013, a bomb hit his house.
I immediately ran outside to check the people, and it was chaos. Like, some people like get hurt, injured. Or it's chaos. It's mess.
His family fled to Egypt, but Jamal couldn't find work, and he was even considering returning to Syria. But then he ran into his uncle, who was visiting from Tokyo, where he lives with his Japanese wife. The uncle offered to bring Jamal and his family to Japan.
So what were your impressions of Japan before you moved here? What did you think it was going to be like?
All Syrians like dream to come to Japan, even before the war, because we know a lot about Japan. Like, we watch a lot of anime.
But it's a hard transition.
Yeah, nobody get into to know, like, the lifestyle, the social life, how hard it is.
He couldn't speak the language, and the culture was completely unfamiliar, even the food. We stop at a convenience store where Jamal buys an onigiri, a rice ball filled with fish. It's good, he says, but it's not Syrian food.
I miss so much Syrian food. Yeah, really miss it. So the ingredients and materials for Syrian food is not existing here. Yeah, everything is different. For example, like the trains, when you get crowded, it's like it was a shock for me the first time. Like, oh my God, what is this? Yeah, and in Syria, we don't work that much as they do here in Japan. It's not so intense. And we all gather together every day, like family, friends. Not like here, I mean, like, you cannot do this in here, I mean, in Japan.
For now, though, Japan is home. The country accepted him as a refugee 4 years ago, and that puts him in a very small group. Last year, Japan took in just one Syrian refugee. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said in 2015 that Japan has to look after its own before taking in refugees. U.S. and European leaders reportedly pressured Abe to do more ahead of last year's G7 meeting, and he announced Japan would take 150 Syrian students as refugees over the next 10 years. But when G7 leaders met again in May, President Trump shifted the agenda from refugees to fighting terrorism. And that could influence Japan's refugee policy, says conservative economist Takaki Mitsuhashi.
At the very least, if the United States is changing its policies to put the national interests of the American people first, then Japan will make policies that put the Japanese people first. And I believe that this would be a positive thing.
Mitsuhashi says putting Japan first is not just about keeping foreigners out. It's about maintaining social cohesion. Last year, Japan granted refugee status to 28 people out of 11,000 applicants. Most were from Afghanistan and Myanmar, and they had to pass an extensive screening process. Jamal, the Syrian refugee, said the interview was the hardest part.
For me, it was one-time interview, like from morning till night. For my mother, it was more than seven times. My mother was so stressed.
So they were asking about what happened to your house? And
you need to prove that your house is destroyed. You need to come up with documents, stories. They keep asking questions to study your reaction.
The Immigration Bureau says it considers each application fairly, using guidelines from the UN Refugee Convention. It already allows a few hundred Syrians to stay temporarily for humanitarian reasons. Jamal thinks they should be granted the same status he and his family have. He's earned a scholarship to study international politics here and now speaks Japanese fluently with friends.
My second home, I got used to life in here. I have a lot of friends now. I still miss Syria too much.
But he doesn't expect to return anytime soon. So he's committed to making a life here, through school, friends, and of course, soccer. He says one day, maybe he'll even make the Japanese team. For The World, Abigail Leonard, Tokyo.
Britain has been hit by a number of high-profile terrorist attacks of late. Our colleagues at the BBC have been learning more about the security threats facing the country and about the legal efforts to stop them. Here's BBC Home Affairs correspondent June Kelly.
5 weeks ago, and terror on London Bridge. The three knifemen continued their murderous rampage in Borough Market before being shot dead by the police. It's believed that two of them wanted to travel to Syria to join so-called Islamic State. This year has seen three Islamist-inspired attacks in the UK, and since March there are said to have been five foiled plots. Well, here on the banks of the Thames by London Bridge, you're a couple of bridges away from the Old Bailey, where many of the terrorism cases are heard. And near here are the headquarters of the Crown Prosecution Service. Its counter-terrorism division works to build cases against IS-inspired defendants, and the evidence can be gruesome. We've been given rare access to lawyers from the counter-terrorism team.
graphic, brutal violence. You know, an image there of people about to be executed by the Islamic State. An image there of a dead body, somebody with their hands bound behind their back. Some of it is absolutely horrific. There are images in here that when you come across them, you recoil from the pages that you're looking at.
Since the first conviction for Syria-related offences in 2014, the BBC has now established that more than 100 other people in the UK have been jailed for terrorism linked to Syria and Iraq. The oldest person convicted is a driving instructor of 63, the youngest a schoolboy from Blackburn who was 14 when he incited an act of terrorism overseas. And a growing number of women and girls have been drawn in. The recent reverses suffered by IS fighters in both Syria and Iraq could have implications for the UK, according to the Director of Public Prosecutions, Alison Saunders.
We need to be acutely aware that if people can't go to Syria, and we have certainly seen this in some of the cases that we have prosecuted, they may plan a sort of attack here instead, or they may do more to radicalise other people to attack. So we need to be very aware of that, and it may mean that the type of prosecutions we're used to have seen in the last few years might possibly change, but we don't know.
When you look out at the landscape before you in the next few years, what do you see?
I don't see the threat necessarily reducing. The battle for law enforcement and our intelligence agencies remaining as high, or the threat as high and as difficult as it has been. I think prosecutors need to think about how they deal with the digital arena as being something we need to make sure they're trained and kept up to date on. That, for prosecutors, is quite a new world to make sure that they're on top of.
The Prime Minister has also demanded a commitment from internet providers and social media platforms to do more to block extremist material. But the challenge to intervene at grassroots and community level is as critical as ever. At this youth centre in East London, they use activities like boxing to try to engage teenagers and fight the extremist ideology which they can be exposed to, both online and face-to-face. The man in charge, Hanif Kadir, who has years of experience in anti-radicalisation, is concerned that the government's attempts to counter extremism may hinder their efforts.
The challenges that we face, going into communities, penetrating the wall of silences, having the credibility, having the trust. Without the community trust, without the community engagement, we can't have conversations, we can't have effective programmes. What it boils down to is mainly having the experience and the understanding of your communities that you need to engage with. Without that experience and without that understanding, you can pump billions into this programme, it won't be effective.
More than 100 people convicted of terrorism, but in the last few months, three Islamist-inspired attacks in London and Manchester have left 35 people dead and many lives changed forever. The government has been under pressure to respond, but how to do that without alienating communities, that's the challenge.
The BBC's June Kelly reporting from London. Rachel Cerati has been traveling for almost a decade. She's on a mission to retrace her grandmother's journey. Cerati's grandmother, Hanna Dubova, was Jewish from what was then Czechoslovakia. When World War II broke out, Hanna was 14. She escaped to Denmark, where she worked on farms until she had to flee again, this time to Sweden. Eventually, Hanna Dubova made her way to the U.S. Rachel has been going to all the places where her grandmother ever lived and meeting many of the people who helped her along the way. She's working on a book about it called Follow My Footprints.
I had always grown up knowing that she was a Holocaust survivor. That was just part of our family narrative. And then in college, knowing I was going to go into photojournalism, I knew she was at the end of her life, and I thought it would be a great time for me to spend one-on-one time with her. And so I asked her for her oral narrative, not quite knowing what I would do with it, but understanding the importance. And then she passed away about a year later, and I discovered this just wealth of archive information. So hundreds of photographs, diary entries, letters to her parents, deportation papers, report cards from her childhood. And I just kind of started puzzling everything together. And for the next 4 years, essentially sat on my bedroom floor and digitized everything and recopied the journals and had things translated. And then I decided to go on the road and go to these places and do my very best to immerse myself into the languages and landscapes and lives that she lived during her close to 20 years of statelessness.
Now, I know when Donald Trump was elected,
The election of Donald Trump affected you and kind of affected how you approached this project and your grandmother's story. In what way?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I started this project in 2009, I found it to be very interesting and very important. I wouldn't necessarily have said it was timely. What we have seen really since 2015, when the refugee crisis started, you know, to become at the forefront of international media, everything started to change a little bit in my eyes, because at that point I was traveling through Europe and rereading a lot of my grandmother's diaries and thinking about how terrified she was to go from one country to another. And here I was traveling through the Schengen zone and feeling, you know, entirely comfortable. But then the refugee crisis started happening. So I was in Sweden meeting with, you know, I've met the family of the fisherman who brought my grandmother's refugee boat to shore in Sweden. And I'm standing there, and they take me to this house that they said my grandmother stayed in the first night. And what I found was a whole group of unaccompanied refugees there again. And that has just, it's really put my head made my head spin a lot.
I know you suffered your own tragedy during this process around the time of the election of Donald Trump. Your husband died suddenly. And you've said that this event also changed the story that you wanted to tell. How?
Yeah. My husband, Sergio, was from Poland. We had met in Israel while we both studied abroad in 2009, actually exactly a month after I first asked my grandmother to tell me her story. So he had been part of my life for much of this. We had been best friends for 5 years before we started dating. And when I had relocated to Europe to work on this project, we started a romantic relationship, and his family immediately brought me into his life. And that gave me a European identity that had kind of been lost through a couple generations of assimilation in America. And it helped me really understand the historical narratives in Europe. So he gave me a lot of perspective in our relationship. And when he passed away, which was very suddenly, just before our one-year anniversary and just after we had celebrated with friends and family on the farm in Denmark, our wedding celebration, you know, I was hit with grief, and I had never really known what grief was. And, you know, here I had spent 8 years studying the story of displacement and grief, and I thought I was understanding it, and all of a sudden I wasn't, because in a matter of minutes I, you know, lost my person and I had to move out of my apartment, and I lost our future plans. I lost the opportunity for us to go live in Europe. There were just, everything got ripped away. Of course, my story is very different than my grandmother's. There's no question about that. But that feeling of loss was not something I really could have channeled before. And in that sense, all of her words felt differently to me. And then there was the election of Donald Trump, and I'm seeing what's happening in politics, and just everything took a different context. The whole story changed. And so I'm trying to catch up to that now, and I'm trying to almost retrace my own steps, whereas before I was retracing hers.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Because you're a very young woman. It must have been very difficult.
Yeah, I was 27 at the time, and it was very sudden.
Based on what you've learned so far in this multi-year project, what do you hope people take away from your story?
Well, I think that a big part of it is to understand that survivor stories don't stop once, you know, life seemingly becomes okay again. And I also really hope that people become curious in their own family history. You know, this family in Denmark that I've become very close with, they were the third of three foster families, but they were the only one that made my grandmother feel at home. And that has proven to still be true two generations later. After Sergio's death, I, you know, have gone back there. I'll be back there this summer. And they have been a huge support in my grieving process, and also the holder of really great memories. And, you know, it's really special to think that two generations ago, my grandmother had the same thing.
Rachel Cerati is working on a book called Follow My Footprints, about her grandmother's story and now her own story. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maleducada. Finally, Buenos Aires-based musician Dat Garcia. If there's one thing she wants you to know about her, is that she likes to do things her way. So we'll let her explain. Maleducada.
I make all the tracks. I record everything at home. And in my music, I love to investigate sounds. I love to say what I'm not supposed to say and to mix things that are not supposed to mix. Que malos han enseñado a vivir, que malos han enseñado, que malos han enseñado.
incluso otra cosa.
I like to investigate in many topics, especially in the social place of the woman. Women have to do everything at home, take care of the kids, go out working. What I mean is we are all equal and we should do everything together.
Musician, feminist, and rebel Dat Garcia from Buenos Aires. Her new album is Maleducada, which basically means misbehave. Dat Garcia takes us out today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. See you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.